Lecture 11, Commemorating the Great War.
Welcome back. There has never in human history been a war that was celebrated as long, as grandly, and as permanently as the war between the Greeks and the Persians that started with Darius's attempts to get across the Aegean and punish Athens back in the 490s, and ended a little over a decade later when the Greek army under that great Spartan regent and general Pausanias beat the remnant of Xerxes' army at Plataea, and when the Greek navy crossed the Aegean and did the same thing to the remnant of Xerxes' Grand Armada. We're going to start with that naval engagement. I said last time that it was the strangest naval battle in history, and it was. As you remember, at the time that the Greek armed forces were gathering from all corners of mainland Greece to form an army almost 40,000 strong and push the Persians out of Greece in 479 BC, a very small fleet had mustered at the island of Aegina, maybe only about 60 ships, but also under the command of a Spartan, the Spartan king Leotychidas, who had gathered together small contingents, apparently with nothing more than the idea initially that they would spend that summer guarding the seaward approaches to Greece from the possibility that Xerxes might send the big fleet back across and might be bringing reinforcements to his army. But there they were at Aegina, a little island in the Saronic Gulf within sight of Athens, and to them came ambassadors from Ionia and from the islands, begging them to send those ships across the sea. The Persians were now demoralized. This was the chance of the mainland Greeks finally to help the Ionians win their freedom from their Persian overlords. At first, Leotychidas, who was a typical Spartan, didn't want to get far from home, didn't want to be drawn away into the unknown, was adamant about not going. But at last, he agreed to go as far as halfway across the Aegean to the holy island of Delos, which we will be visiting again next time. There he sat. He had a whole lot of steersmen in his Greek ships who had not routinely been beyond Delos. It had been a generation since Greek ships could freely navigate in those waters controlled by the Persians. And so the remembrance and the knowledge of the different ports and seaways and reefs and hazards had grown dim. There's a wide open stretch of sea after you get to the end of the Cycladic archipelago, and they just weren't sure what lay beyond. As Herodotus says, it seemed to them as far to Samos and the other side as it was to the Pillars of Hercules. A great exaggeration, but gives some idea of the trepidation they felt. Nonetheless, they continue to receive these envoys, and finally Leotychidas agreed, well, we'll go at least to Samos, to this island within sight of the Asiatic mainland that's been held by Greeks for so long. Arriving there, they discovered that the Persians, at their approach, had fled. The mystique of the Greek navy is now so great that the Persians, even when they outnumber them greatly, will not stand and face them. Remember, the Persians have never been a naval people. They no longer trust their Phoenicians and their other subjects who are providing their ships for the Persian fleet. And so they flee to the mainland, and scouts tell Leotychidas and the other Greeks that they're just around the corner of that mountain. You can see from Samos, they are hiding on the southern slopes of Mount Mycale. So Leotychidas conferred with his other commanders, because each Greek city, there were very few, if any, Spartan ships. These are ships from Aegina itself, from Athens, from Corinth, and he confers about what they should do. The leader of the Athenians is a remarkable man named Xanthippus. To give him the true tribal flavor of his name, that means yellow horse, and he's one of those Athenians that was mad about horse racing. He is also famous to us as the father of the greatest of all Athenian leaders, Pericles, who was at that time a boy of about 14 and still at home with his mother, watching the battles from the heights of Salamis, but not actually getting involved in them yet. His father, Xanthippus, is the leader of this little naval contingent of Athens. Most of the Athenians now, of course, are on the battlefield at Plataea, waiting for the great conflict to happen there. The fleet has been stripped of a lot of its manpower to fight the Persians on land. Xanthippus also urges that they go ahead and attack, take the initiative, even though it's really venturing into the unknown to land on Asiatic soil. So they load boarding bridges onto the ships, these portable wooden contraptions with which you could span the distance between you and an enemy ship once you've rammed them or come alongside, and your Marines, of whom there were very few on each trireme. Triremes were designed for speed in these battles. But your 10 Marines could run across and hope to capture the other ship. And with all this gear, they rowed out of Samos Harbor, around the corner of Mount Mycale, and toward the Persian position. When they got there, expecting that the Persians were going to come out in their hordes of ships and surround them, instead there were no ships to be seen, they realized eventually the enemy navy is on shore. So great was the fear of the Persians for the Greek fleet that they had drawn their triremes up out of the water. These great big long, 120-foot-long vessels with their shallow drafts were now up on land, a fleet on the shore, surrounded by a little palisade. They'd cut down all the fruit trees in the area and created a barrier around the ships, and they had all of their men inside as if they were in a fort filled with ships. So Leotychides told his pilot, his steersman, take my flagship in close to shore. And he told his herald, the Spartan herald, to shout into the Greek camp, O you Ionians who are fighting with the Persians, we are going to attack. This is your chance to win your freedom. Betray your Persian masters. Fight with us. And the watchword of the day was either Hera, the goddess whose temple stood on Samos, or what it actually says in the text of Herodotus, Hebe, another goddess. Her name means youth. Every day in Greek military tradition, there is a watchword, a special code word for the day, and that was the one for that day, the name of one of these goddesses. So Leotychides, for once having a kind of a non-Spartan strategic bit of cunning in mind, is sure that this will either bring the Ionians over to their side and really split the Persian forces, or much more likely, because the Ionians have in fact been, in general, pretty loyal to the Persians, it'll sow seeds of suspicion in the Persian admirals' minds, and they won't trust the Ionians. That is what happened. The Ionians were either disarmed immediately by the Persians under suspicion that they were going to fight for the enemy, or they were sent off out of the camp to guard mountain passes and to keep them out of the battle altogether. The Greek fleet went along the shore to a position well beyond where the Persians had their ships, and they came to shore. This is a difficult maneuver for triremes. They've got to reverse themselves because you can't run up on the beach ram first or you'll break the keel of the ship as well as hurting the ram. You've got to reverse. There's a smooth up-curving stern to each ship with the steering oars dropping into the water there. The pilots then have to turn and look over their shoulders as the crews push the oars in reverse and reverse those ships into the beach. And as soon as they had their upright sterns, their upward curving sterns, hanging over the sand, the Marines drop off onto the shore. You can always make a little army out of the Marines, 10 strong, 14 strong, from any Greek fleet by getting them on shore and assembling them all together. So they had probably about 600 or a few more of their Marines now standing on shore as hoplites, shield to shield, forming this little army. It is an absolutely obligatory thing in Greek military tradition that the post of honor is the right wing. Well, the right wing, since they were facing back west toward the Persian palisade, the right wing, going to the Spartans, is inland and away from the water's edge. And the beach was very narrow. And this meant that the Athenians, who were either on the center or the left, they were on the open sand and were able to march right along toward the Persians. As they advanced toward the Persians, these Spartans got into rough terrain, were swallowed up in a ravine, and disappeared, and the rest of the Greeks were left alone on the beach facing this barrage of Persian arrows from the stockade. The Persians had, in fact, come out and formed a little wicker shield barrier and were shooting from behind it. This is where Xanthippus took the lead. He was determined that the Athenians should not wait for the Spartans. They had, after all, faced these same Persians at Marathon about 11 years earlier. They had charged them then, and he urged his fellow Greeks to pass the word along the line, we're going to charge them now. The best way to get out of the range of a barrage of arrows is close in quickly so that they can't shoot at you anymore. And that's what they did. They ran at those wicker shields. They broke through them. The Persians panicked and ran and climbed back over the barricade of hastily cut fruit tree logs to get back in with the ships. But the Athenians were on their heels, burst into the enclosure and fought it out hand to hand. And as the whole battle hung in the balance, suddenly, like the cavalry arriving on the white horses, the Spartans arrived. They had in fact circled around the upper slopes, came down from above onto the enclosure, and helped win the battle. A few of the Persians escaped to go back to Sardis, where Xerxes was, and carry him word of this final disaster to his fleet. They stripped the Greeks. They stripped the ships of their bronze rams and their treasure chests, because all fleets had to carry war chests with them to pay for the food for the crews and bribe cities to open their gates and so on. And once they'd done that, they looked at the ships. They didn't have enough men to man them. And the last thing they wanted was that they would ever fall back into the hands of Xerxes. And so at the day's end, they lit the world's biggest bonfire, putting all of those ships, all that timber and pitch to the torch. The resulting fire must have been visible 30 miles away to the south at Miletus. And that was the beacon that told the Ionian Greeks, you are free at last of your Persian masters. It was shortly after that that the heralds arrived from Greece saying, on Greek soil also the Persians have been beaten, and giving Leotychidas the report of Pausanias' great victory at Plataea. This was the end of the Persian Wars. The only tailpiece was that Xanthippus, the Athenian, and the Ionians decided to go north to the Hellespont, where the bridges had been, those pontoon bridges of boats and cables that Xerxes had created so he could march with his forces into Greece a year and a half earlier. They laid siege to the great fortress city of Sestos near the mouth of the Hellespont on the other side from Troy. They captured it, and inside the fortress they found the great coils of the papyrus cables. They took those into their triremes and carried them back to Greece as trophies. And now an incredible celebration broke out in many forms and many places all over the Greek world. The first thing to do was to give offerings to the gods in thanks for their victory. So they took the cables, cut them up in sections, and dedicated them in their temples, the Athenians did, so that those who visited them in ages to come would see these amazing sections of the cables of Xerxes' bridge and be reminded that, yes, this man was master of the world, but we Athenians helped to defeat him. They took actual triremes, Phoenician triremes, from the Persian fleet that fought at Salamis, intact ships, hauled them up on land and put them in the sanctuary of Poseidon at Sunion in Attic territory, that famous cape with its crown, with its Doric temple of Poseidon, and then off to the Isthmus of Corinth, also sacred to Poseidon, where the Hellenic League had met, and they dedicated one there in the sanctuary, again to be a memorial for generations yet unborn of this tremendous achievement. They went back to Thermopylae, where no one had been since the disaster in what would have been August of 480 BC, when Leonidas and his 300 were overwhelmed by the Persians pushing their way through the pass at Thermopylae. They collected the bodies of the fallen Spartans. They built a great funeral pyre, cremated them. They discovered, apparently, among the ashes and the bones of the cremated soldiers, that in a few cases, half a dozen or so, the Persian arrowheads and spear points that killed them had still been in their remains and were now mixed up with the ashes. So in the 1930s, when the great Greek archaeologist Spyridon Marinatos excavated the Spartan funeral mound at Thermopylae, he found those Persian arrows interred along with the remains of the fallen Spartan heroes. And on the top of that funeral mound at Thermopylae, they erected a lion, that emblem of Sparta, which was also the animal whose name was enshrined in the name of the king who fell there, Leonidas, the lion's son. The greatest poets in Greece were asked to write epitaphs for the fallen. The most famous one of all was the couplet, the pair of lines in, they don't rhyme in the original Greek, but they said of the Spartans who fell at Thermopylae, go tell the Spartans, passerby, that here at their commands we lie. That's said to be by Simonides. You'll often read that. He was the most famous poet of the time. We don't actually have that ascription in the ancient sources, but it could be his work. Other poets were set to work commemorating people like the Corinthians who fought in the Battle of Salamis, and a beautiful turn of phrase was found for them. Their cenotaph, their empty memorial that looked like a tomb, was built overlooking the battle site on the island of Salamis. The bones of the men who died had actually been sent back to Corinth. there was a lovely little poem on their tomb saying that these men had saved Greece when the affairs of Greece stood upon a razor's edge. And that was how the Greeks saw it. It was one of those moments in history where things could have gone either way at a touch, at the slightest chance event. And somehow, because of all this patriotism and all this surge of willingness to risk one's life to fight the Persians, these people had triumphed. No dead in history were more honored than the dead of Marathon, the dead of Thermopylae, the dead of Salamis. Now, you'll remember that after the Battle of Plataea, Pausanias, the Spartan regent, had had them collect all of the loot, all the booty from the Persian camp. And this included some interesting things. I mentioned the bronze manger out of which the Persian general's horses, he had a big white stallion. The man's name was Mardonius. The stallion had fed, taken its oats and hay out of a bronze manger. The people of Tegea, a little hoplite power from the Peloponnese, they got that as their trophy. The Athenians got the great big field pavilion, the huge tent that Xerxes had left behind with Mardonius. They took it back to Athens, and when they finally built an Odeon, a music hall, Odeon means a place to hear things, they used Xerxes' field pavilion translated into stone as the model for their new Odeon to commemorate, again, the victory at Plataea. And all of the loot having been put together, a tenth of it, a tithe, had to be set aside for the gods, who had to be thanked for giving the Greeks the victory. So they took that tenth aside, they melted a lot of it down, and they created a remarkable memorial at Delphi, the site of the Delphic Oracle that had predicted the wooden walls would save Athens and had told the Greeks to pray to the winds, and the Delphic Oracle that seemed so involved in so much. They took the bronze from all the captured Persian helmets and armor, they melted it down and they created a column which was actually the bodies of three great serpents coiled together and rising up in the air, and then on top of the column was set a golden tripod. On the coils of the column, under the rubric, "These fought for Greece," were the names of the 31 cities and islands who had actually joined the Freedom Fighters, the Hellenic League meeting at the Isthmus, and had won that incredible victory. The 31st name had been added afterwards. It was the little tiny island of Tenos out in the Aegean. And after they'd already inscribed the column, the people of Tenos, or maybe their friends in Athens, reminded the Spartans, who had directed the creation of the serpent column, you need to put Tenos on there too. On the night before the Battle of Salamis, when the Persian armada was flowing in its triple line into the straits by moonlight, and we Greeks were sitting in darkness on the other side of the channel on the island of Salamis, not sure whether there would be a battle the next day or not, not sure whether Themistocles' ruse of sending a messenger with a false message to Xerxes to bring them into the straits, there appeared out of the darkness one ship, one trireme from the island of Tenos, that had learned about the plan, had been part of Xerxes' fleet, realized that they might be joining the losing side, and yet had broken ranks, had slipped away in the darkness, came to us and gave us the message that assured us that when the sun came up the next morning, we would see the Persians in the straits and we would be ready for a fight. They need to be on this column too. So Tenos is the last of those 31 names. There were also new temples to new gods, especially at Athens. The Athenians declared Boreas, the north wind, a god because he had come down out of the northern mountains, struck the sea, and destroyed so many Persian ships, thus bringing down the numbers of Xerxes' grand fleet. And a god that had been around for a long time but never worshipped at Athens, the god Pan, whose name actually is in Greek everything, Pan is the god of wild places. And when Pheidippides, that Athenian runner, ran from Athens to Sparta before the Battle of Marathon, that running day and night to carry the word that the Persians had landed and the Athenians needed help from their Spartan allies, help that they did not receive. As he ran back, no doubt kind of weakened from loss of sleep and the incredible rigors of running there and back in consecutive days, he had a vision. He saw the god Pan stop him over one of the mountain passes and say, "Pheidippides, ask the Athenians why they do not pay me tribute and worship me. If they will pay me honors, I will help them beat the Persians." And the Athenians attributed their success at Marathon partly to Pan. His name is the root of our word panic, which is also a Greek word. The idea is that Pan, the god of wild places, will infect a mass of people with irrational fear. They will scatter in flight. That's what happened with the Persians at Marathon. And so, in thanks to Pan, a temple to him and a cult of Pan was created in Athens. The most wondrous of all of the celebrations of the Persian Wars was created 8 years after the Battle of Salamis by a man who fought in that battle and who also fought at Marathon, the Athenian poet Aeschylus. Now, we know that one of the things we owe to Athens is the theater, drama, tragedy, and comedy. In the form that we know those great forms of literature and cultural creativity, they're Athenian inventions. And Aeschylus is the man who really got tragedy started. He had a contemporary named Phrynichus who had had the idea of taking current history and turning it into plays. You remember back in the Ionian Revolt, after the Battle of Lade at sea, when the Persian fleet managed to defeat the Ionians, they then mopped up on land by recapturing the rebellious Ionian cities. The greatest of these was Miletus. Miletus was the city that was closest to the heart of the Athenians and was, in fact, in a sense, a colony from Athens. And it was the capture of Miletus by the Persians that Phrynichus made the subject of a play shortly after the Persians put down the Ionian Revolt and took those cities back into their empire. The Athenians wept all the way through the play as they saw the enactment of this recent history and were so angry at the playwright for making them cry that they fined him a huge amount of money. Nothing daunted, he, after the great success at Salamis, he was sponsored by Themistocles, who was the Athenian commander at the time and took credit for the victory at Salamis, sponsored by Themistocles in putting on a new tragedy called The Phoenician Women, which was all about the battle at Salamis. These ancient Greek tragedies are often named for what their chorus was dressed up as. There are one, two, or three actors who will play the parts of the sort of solo performers, the individuals, but there's always a chorus, which is a mass of people who sing and who dance and who really provide the show and the spectacle for the dramatic presentation. And their name, what they are, is often given as the name of the play. The Phoenician women, who are they? Well, they are the wives of the Phoenician mariners who fought at Salamis and who died in such huge numbers. So it was a mourning play, a great play of grief on the part of these Phoenicians who had fought for Xerxes at Salamis, although nothing of the play survives. We know that. We also know how it began. You're at the court in Susa, waiting for news of Xerxes and his great fleet and his great army. It's the year 480 BC, and there's a eunuch, sort of subsidiary actor with pillows, going around and placing them for the Persian counselors who are going to come in and get the news of the Battle of Salamis. Themistocles sponsored that one. It was traditional in Athens that the dramas were competitions in honor of the great god Dionysus. And the leading citizens of Athens, the richest men, would take it in turns to be sponsors of these plays, put them on for the people's entertainment, but also their education and their spiritual enrichment. Young Pericles, the son of Xanthippus, who had now come to manhood, his father had died shortly after the great successes at Mycale and Sestos. Pericles is now head of his household, owner of one of the great fortunes in the city of Athens, and he takes money from the family coffers, even though he's only in his early 20s, and he works with this great poetic genius, Aeschylus, on a play that was a little like Phrynichus' Phoenician Women, but far grander. That play has survived, copies of it have survived. It's the oldest drama we know of, still surviving in the world. It was presented in the year 472 BC, sponsored by Pericles, written and produced and probably acted by Aeschylus. And it had that same idea of taking you to the Persian court. But it's called the Persians because the chorus are the gorgeously clad elders of Persia, the princes and aristocrats who stayed home in Susa. The chief characters are the queen mother, Atossa, the widow of King Darius and the mother of King Xerxes, who has all of a mother's anxiety and forebodings about her son. Aeschylus started his play with the elders gathering at the court for yet another day of waiting for news of Xerxes and his expedition. They have every reason to be confident. They keep reciting those lists of the big battalions that were sent against Greece and saying, how could they not succeed? But they have forebodings, and when the queen comes in, she and the elders feed off each other's sense of dread, and she recounts to them a terrifying dream she had, where Xerxes is a charioteer, and his two horses are Asia and Greece. And Asia moves smoothly and proudly through its paces, whereas Greece is a rebellious horse, kicking and ultimately throwing the young charioteer out of the chariot and injuring him there on the ground. She's terrified by this. She asks for the elders to interpret her dream for her, but they instead bid her to call up the ghost of her dead husband, Darius, the earlier king, and ask him. So Darius is conjured up out of the stage. This is the second actor. And he hears all of what's going on. He's appalled at what Xerxes has done. They tell him about the bridge of boats across the Hellespont. He thinks, what madness was this? So they are left with even more terror than they felt before. And sure enough, hard on the heels of the apparition of King Darius comes the messenger from having run or ridden that last messenger in the line who's come along the royal road with the reports of the Battle of Salamis. I shouldn't say the last messenger in the line. This is an exceptional case in Aeschylus' mind. This is a man who saw Salamis, saw the defeat of the Persians in the Straits, and has come now himself to give the word to Queen Atossa and the elders at home. This is the longest speech in the play. It's one of the longest speeches in any Greek play because it's the entire Battle of Salamis, envisioned from the Persian side and seen through Persian eyes. I've had the good luck to see the Persians performed at Loyola Marymount by students in California. I've seen it performed in New York City by the National Theater Company of Greece. It's often described by scholars as a jingoistic play, a sort of rattling the standard and cheering on part of the Athenians and rubbing it in the noses of the Persians that they lost. I went to see it in California with Larry Tridle, who's a great classicist and a Vietnam veteran, and he said to me, nobody's ever been in combat thinks the Persians is a play that is glorying over the enemy. Instead, you are seeing the tragedy that befalls anybody who falls into the world of war. And there are great moments in the Persians where one feels that great sympathy that Aristotle said tragedy should evoke, the sense of catharsis and identification. And you feel it for the Persians, and I certainly felt it in both of the productions that I saw once I was there and experiencing it, not as a scholarly text on a page, but as a theatrical drama on stage. One of the great moments, of course, in the messenger speech is the charge of the Greeks. The messenger has described the demon that came out of the night and gave Xerxes the false information that lured him into the straits. He then goes on to the movement of Xerxes' fleet into the straits by night, and then with the breaking of day, the horses of dawn leap into the sky, and they hear the trumpet, they hear the singing of the Greeks, the war cry, they realize that they have been fooled, and then they hear the battle cry of the Greeks. And it's an extraordinary moment, and the lines of the battle cry are, "Go, sons of Greece, free your fatherland, free your children, wives, tombs of your forefathers, shrines of your ancestral gods, fight now for all." Some of the most patriotic lines and images ever conceived, and probably since Aeschylus was there, caring for us 2,500 years later, the authentic battle cry that sounded over the waters at Salamis. Earlier on, Aeschylus took the chance of having an exchange between the queen and the elders, which tried to show how the Persians might look at Athens. And I'd like to end with this. They are there on the stage, and the queen is questioning the elders about what they know about this distant city, this tiny place which has dared to challenge the great Persian Empire. "Tell me, where does Athens lie?" "Far westward, where the sun god sinks his fainting fires." Atossa, the queen, "Why should my son yearn to make this town his prey?" "Athens once conquered, he is master of all Greece." Atossa, "Have they such a rich supply of fighting men?" "They have. Soldiers who once struck Persian arms a fearful blow," a reference to Marathon. Atossa, "Besides their men, have they good store of wealth at home?" Chorus, "They have a spring of silver in the earth." And that's a reference to the discovery of the silver that built the ships that fought at Salamis. "Are they skilled in archery?" "No, not at all. They carry stout shields. They fight hand to hand with spears. Who shepherds them? What master do their ranks obey? Master, they are not called servants to any man. And if that line did not get a cheer in the Theater of Dionysus in Athens when it was premiered in 472 BC, I would truly be amazed. There you have in dramatic form the Greeks' own view of what set them apart from the Persians. It was their love of freedom, it was their love of liberty and independence that made them supermen in that hour, that enabled them to defy the forces of history, turn what seemed like an inevitable defeat into the most shining and glorious victory that the Greeks would ever know.